Gospel with support from Verde Gallery, currently showing Vision to Verse, Verse to Vision, a visual and poetic dialogue, paintings by Jessica Damon, and poetry by Maj Regain. Verde Gallery, a fine art gallery, cafe, and newsroom featuring hundreds of unique magazines. At 11 East Taylor, downtown Champaign. On the web at www.verdant-systems.com. Be inspired.
Today's broadcast is made possible in part by Euromart International Food Store on Springfield and Locust in Champaign, offering 200 kinds of chocolate, 40 kinds of coffee, and 200 kinds of tea. The Euromart hosts a cheese and olive tasting every Saturday.
This is the Afternoon Magazine on WILL AM 580. Good afternoon. Thanks for joining us this afternoon. My name is Celeste Quinn, and with me in the studio this afternoon, Chuck Voigt. He's here to talk with us this afternoon about urban vegetable gardening. Chuck is Principal Research Specialist in Agriculture, Natural Resources, and Environmental Sciences at the University of Illinois, and he joins us from time to time during the growing season to answer our questions about herbs and vegetables. He is co-author with J.S. Vandermark of the book Vegetable Gardening in the Midwest. The book is a publication of the Cooperative Extension Service. Listeners, you can join us with your questions. Join us with a telephone call. We look forward to hearing from you this afternoon. In the Champaign-Urbana area, the number 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, if it would be a long-distance call for you, use the toll-free number, 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. Welcome back.
Good to be here.
Good to see you. So how are things in your garden?
Probably pretty weedy. I've been gone for a couple of weeks, and typically at this time of the year, they go from those little sweet-looking seedling weeds to
monsters,
big things shading out everything in sight pretty quickly.
Yeah. So you were away. You went to Wichita to a herb conference?
I did. It was good. Saw a lot of old herbal friends, and surprisingly, there was more to see and do herbally in Wichita than the average person might think.
Really?
There's an alternative health center there that we went and spent a day at that was quite interesting, where medical doctors blend herbal medicine and conventional medicine in a pretty unique fashion, and so we got to hear about that.
Yeah, that's interesting. What else? What other kind of topics did you tackle at the conference?
Well, we talked about oregano because that's going to be the herb of the year next year.
Uh-huh.
And we kind of had a garlic forum because the conference went biennial, so we didn't get to talk about garlic, which is the herb of the year this year. So, and everybody loves garlic, so
right.
we had quite an interesting discussion about garlic. And you know, we went on tours and saw a tall grass prairie preserve and a small grower who's just getting started and a Mennonite museum, and it was kind of an eclectic blend of things out there, but. Kansas in the summer. Who'd have thought?
Yeah, very good. Wichita. Sounds like a nice place to visit.
It actually is. It's the largest city in Kansas, and there's a lot of cultural things going on, and a nice little botanic garden.
There you go.
Cowtown Museum, from the cattle drive days and all of this.
So what kind of garlic have you got growing this year? Speaking of garlic, I know you're a big garlic.
Yeah, I got all but four or five cultivars dug before I left, and the rest are going to come out this weekend. I have about 50 different kinds. The big hits of the conference were Music and Spanish Roja, which I had just dug and had big plump cloves and nicely purple striped bulb wrappers, and they were quite beautiful.
Yeah. Now, at these conferences that you go to, do you and your buddies get together and, you know, get to enjoy that garlic in terms of do you get to cook?
Well, we actually did a tasting. We had a toaster oven that I took along, and we roasted, you know, cloves of different varieties, and then we like had half cloves or something of them raw, so you could taste the difference that you know, how it mellows and sweetens and loses a lot of the bite, you know, when it's roasted. So we did a little bit of tasting.
Oh, that sounds good. I haven't had lunch yet.
A lot of sending the air in the room.
This is the Afternoon Magazine. Chuck Voigt is our guest here on the program this afternoon. You can join us with your questions about herbs and vegetables, 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455, 333-WILL, 800-222-WILL. Well, what do you do now at this stage? You've been away for a while, and those weeds are huge. What do you tackle first?
Well, I have to walk all around and just assess where we are with different things. We're getting to the point where there may be potatoes that need to be dug because the tops on some of the early varieties are probably, in the couple of weeks since I've seen them, have probably matured and starting to go down. Beyond that, you know, fire up the tiller and start making tracks.
Yeah, yeah. Well, in a sense, I suppose somebody like you has, you know, you can do that in your garden, but those of us who have to go out there and do it on our hands and knees, you know.
Well, I think if were I in a perfect world and were I gardening in a small area in the backyard or whatever, I think if I knew I was going to be gone for 2 weeks, I would be really careful to get things mulched and pretty much under control so that the weeds don't even get started while I'm gone. And mulch would also, you know, if it happened to be dry while I was gone, would hold in some soil moisture. And I would have to do that if that were the situation. But because I'm spread out so much and have the capability of catching up mechanically, then I get lazy and don't do it. Well, lazy isn't a really good word because I do go out and work hard, but I don't have to plan ahead as well as I might otherwise.
Yeah, yeah. And there are some, well, in my smaller setting, you know, there are things that I've learned to look for that I've got to, you know, you kind of do what you, you know, triage, you know, weed triage. This I've got to start on right now, and that guy over there, that patch can wait for a little bit. We've got a listener who's waiting to talk with us on line one in Champaign. Good afternoon.
Yes, I have a question about garlic and growing of garlic, which I've tried over the years. Apparently, the crop is fairly healthy in the sense that it grows well, and I've tried several different varieties. The soil is a good black loam, but the garlic heads come out to be pretty small by the time we're ready to harvest them. And I was wondering if it's the right kind of soil, and I do fertilize during the growing season.
Okay. The first question I would ask is, are you planting in the fall or in the spring?
Plant in the fall, usually late September or October.
Okay, that's right. If the first thing people usually don't get right with garlic is they try to plant it in the spring and it's out of whack with the season and doesn't develop right. Second question is, are you growing garlics that make top sets?
I've tried the top sets. I've tried hard neck, and I've tried the soft neck, various varieties.
Okay, and do you remove the top sets when they start to come out?
No, I haven't.
Well, that usually, on most varieties, that will make a 25 to 30% difference in the size of the bulbs, just getting those off so that the plant doesn't spend a lot of energy making those bulblets up there and concentrates it into the main bulb.
Okay, but the soft neck, which doesn't have those little top bulbs,
right,
also come out relatively small. Do they need a sandy soil? I mean, it's sort of a heavy, dense loam.
Right. I've grown them down here on the South Farm in Drummer, which is a black clay loam soil. And it's done pretty well there. most of what I grow is on sandier soil up in Kankakee County. And it's, if nothing else, it's easier to dig there because it doesn't, you know, that fine textured stuff gets really hard as it dries out, which it usually does in July when it's time to dig them.
Hmm. So nothing stands out as being...
Well, here, in the spring, when the garlic, the fall planted garlic starts to grow, probably the first or second week of April here, about the time the farmers out in the fields are getting excited and starting to plant field corn, a side dress of nitrogen fertilizer encourages the plants to grow larger. And then maybe not a lot, maybe a pound of actual N per 1,000 feet of row, not a lot, but then come back in a month after that and repeat that. And that really encourages the leaves to grow and take up a lot of energy. And then in June, when the long days tell it to start bulbing, you have as much foliage as possible that feeds that bulb. I found if I miss doing at least one of those spring feedings, the bulb size definitely does suffer. So if you haven't been doing that, you might want to go out and give them a side dress of nitrogen. That can be commercial fertilizer, or that can be, you know, some organic compost tea or something like that.
I guess I fertilize it only once in the springtime, so maybe the secret is to fertilize it more than once.
Right. Get the first one done fairly early, and then 3 or 4 weeks later, do it again, and then back off, because after that, you don't want to encourage it to grow because it's going to be wanting to bulb and stop growing, so you don't really want to push it too much beyond that.
Okay. Thanks very much.
Okay.
Okay, next we go to a listener in Champaign on line two. Hi.
Hi. I wonder if you could tell me what might be stripping the stems of my fennel and dill of the fern-like growth. Would that be a worm or?
The larvae of a swallowtail butterfly typically get on all the plants in that family and do a good bit of leaf stripping.
How do I deal with that?
Well, if you can find them, they're sort of camouflaged in black and yellowish green so that they sort of blend in with the foliage. You can do a lot of control just physically by taking them off and doing away with them.
Mm-hmm.
If you have a small amount of it, you can get some pretty severe damage. If you have a lot...
Well, I can't get started because the stems get stripped down before the plant even gets going.
Okay. Well, and if you don't see the worms, then maybe it's something else. I don't know if you had problems with slugs or...
No, not in this area.
Okay. Well, the typical thing that happens to plants in fennel, dill, parsley, things in that plant family is the swallowtail butterfly larvae. So
I guess it wouldn't help to... I shouldn't spray, should I?
Well, if you... Yes, BT spray would be good for that. That's specific for caterpillars.
Yes. Okay. So is it the caterpillar that's eating the fern?
Yes.
It is.
If that is indeed the problem, it's the caterpillar that eats it. The butterfly eats nectar and just would sit on flowers and be pretty.
Okay. So I'm not making the herb dangerous for consumption by using the BT.
No, the BT is a disease of caterpillars only, and it's pretty much inert as far as everything else goes, even other insects.
Okay, well, great. Thank you.
Okay.
Okay, good luck.
Hi.
Let's talk with a listener in Urbana now, line three. Good afternoon.
Hi.
Hi.
I've seen suggestions that heavy clay soils can be improved with the addition of gypsum. And I'm thinking specifically of clay soils that we have at a farm in Ohio in our vegetable garden. And I'm wondering, I've never seen gypsum around. And somebody else was telling me that he was in town to do a workshop on permaculture, a week-long program on permaculture. And he suggested using gypsum for if you're planting trees in that kind of soil. So I'm wondering where you get it. And he said granulated gypsum. I think of that as being wallboard stuff, you know, sheetrock.
We probably don't want to be shedding sheetrock. boy, I can't tell you off the top of my head where to find it. You might, have you tried, you know, some of the local places, the FS Farmtown, someplace like that, that kind of straddles the line between farmer and homeowner? Because it might be something that a place that stocks farm stuff, farm materials would be more likely to have than just your average.
Farm and Fleet or Farmtown?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, maybe.
Someplace
like that. I think the way that works is it tends to make the tiny clay granules stick together to form secondary particles, you know, so you have like little lumps within the soil rather than this uniform, fine textured stuff that tends to stick together.
He said that clay is actually like flat plates.
Yes.
That stick together, and that the gypsum makes it curl up so that they don't form this essentially impermeable. Clay
right.
soils are pretty impermeable.
Right.
Does anybody use gypsum in the soils that you have around Champaign-Urbana? Is that worth doing?
You know, I don't know that much about it. Organic matter is what I've always tried to use to do that. It has that same sort of ability to the humic acids tend to stick together the clay particles so that they don't form that homogeneous impenetrable kind of a mass, but instead, you know, gather in groupings so that water and air can pass between the groupings rather than having the tight little clay particle to clay particle brick wall kind of a thing going on.
Well, that's what I do in my garden, actually, and we've been using compost since 73, maybe,
mm-hmm.
and you can tell where I've used it and where I haven't managed to dig it in. It's
okay, well,
the soil is much better. I mean, there are places where there's a plant that's been there for a long time, and then it dies,
mm-hmm.
and you can tell I haven't worked any compost into it, so
yeah.
it does make a big difference.
Well, you know, if you can find the gypsum, it might be worth a try. Try to get as much organic matter in as you can. I know around here you can, in the fall, you can pretty much, if you beat the recycling truck around, you can pretty much have all the leaves that you want because people bag them up and put them out on, mm-hmm. on the curb. Also here in town, you could go to the recycling center and they actually do composting and residents can get compost that way. You might want to do a little bit of like cover cropping or green manure cropping in the garden if you have a bed that's vacant. Just grow something that grows up quickly that you can till back into the soil. Just to keep adding organic matter because organic matter really, really opens up tight soils.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, I was mainly calling about the garden in Ohio, and
right.
It's really damp, heavy soil, much heavier than in around here even. Thanks a bunch.
Okay.
Thanks for the call this afternoon. I suppose the Extension folks out in the Buckeye State might be of some assistance,
yeah,
too.
Yeah, I would think, yeah. If they should be real familiar with their local soils and know what works. I just know generally that organic matter works well, and I've heard that gypsum has that effect. I wouldn't want to overdo gypsum because with anything, if you get one nutrient out of whack, it can affect other things.
Okay, very good. Chuck Voigt is our guest this afternoon here on the Afternoon Magazine. We're talking with him this afternoon about growing herbs and vegetables in the garden. If you'd like to join us with a question or a comment, pick up the phone and give us a call. The numbers in the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455. 800-222-WILL. No one waiting at the moment. Let's talk about the herb of the year for next year, oregano. What a nice herb.
Yeah. Well, and we lumped the whole genus in there so if oregano is too strong for you, you can celebrate marjoram too, because the genus Oreganum you know, whether people call it a marjoram or an oregano is pretty much arbitrary.
Yeah, they are very similar, aren't they?
Right, it's the same genus. And it's kind of like that pumpkin squash discussion that we have. You know, is it a pumpkin? Is it a squash? It's all in what you call it.
Yeah. Outside of them, you know, when I think of oregano and marjoram, I think of, you know, I think of tomatoes. Are there other ways to use these herbs?
Yeah, marjoram is pretty subtle. And it works well in, like, light white cream sauces or things like that where you just want a hint of something.
Mm-hmm.
Where oregano is more the bold pizza sauce. Or like in Mexican cooking, you would use a lot of oregano because it's a real bold, really good oregano. Kind of gives you a little bite back on the end of your tongue when you taste it. So it depends on if you want something bold or something mild. And it's amazing that plants as closely related as they are can be that different.
Be that different, yeah. Well, it's amazing to me the differences, you know, in say, the basil family. It's a huge variety. You know, you can go from something that's relatively mild to something that just screams at you.
Right, yeah. The difference in the various essential oil components varies a lot from variety to variety in the basils. Like one will have a lot of cinnamon in it and some will have... some that start to taste a little bit medicinal will have a lot of camphor
kind of
in it. Right.
Yeah. This is the Afternoon Magazine. Chuck Voigt, our guest this afternoon. 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. Anywhere else, toll free, 800-222-9455. I wanted to ask you, thinking back to the caller with the vegetable garden out in the clay soils of Ohio, I picked up some soil at the, I don't even remember where I got it now, but anyway, to do some container gardening, and boy, that stuff was terrible. What do I look for in terms of, you know, if you're going to buy soil for container gardening, are there things on the package that you should look for, or,
yeah,
or should I put, you know, should I mix it up with compost, or what should I do?
A lot of what gets bagged up and sold is what is commonly called in the trade Michigan muck. It's a sedge peat, but it's black. It doesn't have a lot of nutrient value. It doesn't hold on to nutrients especially well. It's kind of sticky and slimy, but because it has such a nice black color, people associate
great.
That with a really rich soil, and so. Rather than buying, you know, a more conventional peat and perlite, peat and vermiculite kind of a material that's going to be brown with flecks in it and probably works better for container growing things. You know, people get this black stuff and feel really good about it, and then the nutrient relations in that is just horrible. So,
yeah. Well, the plant screamed and fell over.
And I don't know if they have to say it's a sedge peat, or I don't know what, I haven't looked at the fine print on the bags, but try to avoid that. Stick a finger through the plastic and feel this is kind of a black, slimy mass. You might want to avoid it.
And they're so clever, too, because on a lot of the packages, you can't see it, you know?
Yeah, they're
that's like, you know, it's like it's that classic pig in a poke.
Right. Right, and the other thing is, if it's really really cheap, chances are it's not going to be excellent. On the other hand, just because it's expensive doesn't mean it's going to be good. But usually, the really really cheap stuff is cheap because it's the cheapest thing they can scrape off of an organic soil somewhere in Michigan or somewhere.
333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455. If you're just joining us this afternoon, this is the Afternoon Magazine on AM 580, and we're talking about herbs and vegetables today and gardening with Chuck Voigt. He's Principal Research Specialist in Agriculture, Natural Resources, and Environmental Sciences at the University of Illinois. He's also the co-author with J.S. Vandermark of the book Vegetable Gardening in the Midwest. The book is a publication of the Cooperative Extension Service. 333-9455, 800-222-9455. How's the weather been for you this year?
Well, it's been
relatively easy on humans. We haven't had a lot of really blistering heat. We've had some humidity, which may have fostered a little bit of leaf disease, but usually it seems like something blows through and we have a storm and it cools off again. And so it's been pretty easy living. As I think we talked about earlier, my sweet potato trial, of course, would like it to be tropical. You know, 2 years ago was great because it got hot in June and stayed hot until September, and the sweet potatoes just soaked that up. And they don't look bad now, so I'm hoping that we're getting enough sunshine and other things that they're doing okay. And they are under black plastic, so that does help.
A little homemade sauna there.
Although another couple of weeks and the vines will pretty much have covered the plastic, so at that point, we'll be in the dead of summer, and hopefully everything will work out.
Let's talk with a listener on a cell phone on the toll-free line. Line 4, go ahead.
Hello, Steph. How are you doing this afternoon?
Good.
Fine. How are you?
Okay. I have a question concerning cucumbers and cantaloupe. My wife and I planted some cucumbers, and they came up.
Boy, we have a really bad connection. You're coming in and out. Cucumbers and cantaloupe. Maybe you can just riff a little bit here. I don't know.
Okay, cucumbers and cantaloupes are subject to the same diseases and problems. Although the plants look very similar and the blossoms look very similar, they do not cross-pollinate. So if you have a bitter cantaloupe, it's probably for some other reason than because a cucumber got cross-pollinated with it. If there were to be a problem, it would, if somehow they did get cross-pollinated, which they won't, it would only, the seed that was produced by that would produce a fruit that had a problem later down the line. What else?
Pest problems?
Bacterial wilt is a big problem with both of those things. Bacterial wilt is carried by the striped cucumber beetle. It overwinters in the stomach of the mature beetles. They come out in the spring. They have very strong sensory capability of hunting down little seedlings of any of the vine crops, but particularly like pumpkin squash and cucumbers and muskmelons. Then they take a few bites, and as soon as they relieve themselves, they release the bacterium, which is overwintered inside them. It gets onto the surface where they've just been feeding. The plant gets infected, and then a few weeks later, tragically, about the time the first fruits start to mature, the whole plant wilts down and dies. The commercial solution to that is to kill the beetles before they take that second bite, and that can be fairly effective. In a home garden, you can use a floating row cover to get that down tightly all around the plants, and until they start to flower, they can be under that floating row cover because they like the warmth, and you're excluding the beetles that carry the bacterium, and so that gives you that 3 or 4 week head start when you have to take it off when the blossoms need to be pollinated, because you have to have insect access to get that done. But if they're infected at that point, the time delay before the disease takes the plant down is usually such that you've harvested pretty much the whole crop by the time bacterial wilt can catch up with them. So that's a couple of things about those things. How about if I riff about cantaloupes?
Okay.
Almost nobody in the U.S. has ever seen a cantaloupe.
Those melons are not cantaloupes?
They're all muskmelons.
Okay.
And I think it's a PR thing. Cantaloupe is a prettier sounding word than muskmelon. Especially when a lot of people pronounce it mushmelon, and that gets to be a problem. A true cantaloupe is a Mediterranean melon that we almost never see in U.S. markets. It's to the point, it's like yams and sweet potatoes. It's a battle that you almost don't fight. But since I don't know what we're talking about, I thought I'd just throw that in. And sometimes it's hard for me to say cantaloupe when I know I'm talking about a muskmelon.
Okay. Let's talk with another listener. Caller in Spring Bay, line 4. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. afternoon. Well, I don't know whether it's cantaloupe or muskmelon, but I'm growing a heritage Hearts of Gold.
Okay.
And this is my second year as a market grower. Got a good crop coming on, real sandy soil here.
Okay.
But I'm wondering if I'm getting some wilt. I've got probably 2% of the vines are stressed out, dying back, leaves are browning. So do you think it's too late to get in there with the bees are working the crop now? Mm-hmm. I mean, if I put a spray on for those cucumber beetles, what do you think?
I would say the best you can do at this point is to get the infected plants out of there so that the cucumber beetles aren't feeding on them. And beyond that, we may be past the point where if they're infected today, you're going to be past harvest by the time it's a problem, probably. It's the ones that were infected weeks ago that are showing the signs now.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, well, I was concerned about if I started pulling on the vines, if I would be spreading some kind of spore or something like
that.
Well,
there is a bacterial ooze that's in the plants, but
these roots at the base of the plant, it seems to be solid. I don't see any ooze at all.
Yeah. Well, if you cut one of the affected stems and rub the ends together,
yeah,
and then pull them apart, that's where you would usually see the bacterial ooze streaming.
Okay. All right, great, yeah.
And you know, once you're done harvesting, either get the vines cleaned up or then maybe spray then so that you cut down the overwintering population of the beetles that will infect you next year.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay?
Thanks a lot.
You're welcome.
Okay, 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455. Herbs and vegetables, our topic in this portion of the afternoon magazine. Herbs and vegetables in the home landscape. Our guest this afternoon, Chuck Voigt of the University of Illinois. Speaking of beetles, you know what hasn't been bad Japanese beetle-wise?
Or some wood.
Yeah,
I was driving down the interstate, and you can pick out the linden trees because they're that light tan color, which means all the chlorophyll's been stripped off of them, and it's just the leaf veins left. Generally speaking, last year and this year, it seems like we may have gotten to the point where some of the natural diseases, whatever, of Japanese beetle have caught up with them. And hopefully this is the level we'll have to live with forever rather than past years when they were just horrible.
Yeah. Well, this year might not be so good for the Japanese beetle from a Japanese beetle perspective, but, man, it's a great year if you're a rabbit. And, you know, this morning, Dr. Julia Whittington was here, you know, from the U of I Vet Med Clinic. She's the wildlife specialist.
And that's how we got to rabbits.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes, that's how we got to rabbits. And she said it's just been a great year for you know, the population is just burgeoning.
Right.
So maybe next year they'll have a bad year.
I don't think the rabbit population and the Japanese beetle population really have too much effect on each other.
No, but I think of them, you know, as critters that can, you know, eat right through the landscape.
Right. They can disappoint you in a hurry with your garden.
Yeah. Well, there's been, you know, we had a rabbit actually coming up onto the porch.
Yeah, I had one standing in a flower pot eating leaves off a hibiscus looking defiantly at me.
Amazing. And they're not even, they really, yeah, like you said.
Suburban rabbits are a whole other breed. They're just pretty arrogant about the whole situation.
They're not concerned about us at all.
No, not like a good country rabbit that at least gets hunted often enough so that they recognize danger when it be there in front of them.
Well, what else should we talk about here this afternoon? We don't have much on the way here of callers today. I don't know why that is.
Well, it's a really nice day after several days. Maybe everybody's outside.
Yeah. Boy, it's a beautiful day out there. And it will be wonderful to work in the garden this weekend. Public gardens in the area that you would recommend that we take a look at? for ideas? Well, we got the idea garden.
The idea garden, the trial garden, the Hartley Garden right there in the same area on South Lincoln. There's always a lot to be learned there. Chicago Botanic Garden is hard to beat. Getting longitudinally through the Chicago traffic is the worst part about that. Once you're there, it's a great day up there to see all sorts of things. Same with St. Louis Botanic Garden, heading the other way.
If it's not too hot.
Yeah, you might want to back off from that for a while or hope for a cold front. I'm trying to think of something. Luthi Botanic Garden in Peoria is kind of little known. It's kind of hidden in downtown Peoria there.
Really?
And once you find it, that's kind of a nice little oasis there. Peoria is easier to get to than either Chicago or St. Louis, and probably going to be a little more moderate temperature-wise and stuff than certainly St. Louis will be. Chicago is usually pretty good because they're so close to the lake that they get breezes off the lake that cool you off.
Yeah. Isn't there a botanical garden? It's been years since I've been to Milwaukee and been in the city proper, but don't they have a pretty nice botanical garden as well?
Borner Botanical Garden is somewhere up there in the suburbs. Also, University of Wisconsin-Madison, I think, has a good arboretum. If you're going north, which isn't a bad idea this time of the year, either Madison or Milwaukee. A place I like in southeastern Wisconsin is Old World Wisconsin. They've brought in buildings representing all the different people who settled Wisconsin, the different ethnic groups, brought that in and condensed it so you have like a Swedish farm and a German farm and different things, and then they have trams that take you around. It's like almost a square mile, and so they each can be isolated, so you kind of get the feeling of going to a different ethnic thing. And then they have a little village where you can start to see how those things came together to form a more American thing. So if you're at the Chicago Botanic Garden, it's only like an hour or so more to go up there into Wisconsin, to Old World Wisconsin, which...
That's the name of the community?
Yeah.
Old World Wisconsin.
Right.
Okay.
Because it's all the different people who came there to settle and made Wisconsin what it is today.
Yeah. I have not been to it yet, but there's a lovely public garden in Rockford. It has a wonderful reputation. Anderson, is it Anderson Gardens? I can't recall now. I've been meaning to, when I'm up there in my hometown.
Right, yeah, it seems like the Clems had a nursery over there and had something to do with starting some sort of a botanic garden or something there.
It's near the river, near the Rock River.
Yeah, I don't know Rockford that well.
Yeah. I grew up there, but the garden is a new that's relatively recent. I think it was an individual made it available to the public.
I hear that the Meyer Garden in outside Grand Rapids is in Michigan is also has become very nice. The Meyer as in the store that we have here. There's Grand Rapids is like the home office and they have a very nice garden set up there.
Yeah. Okay, we have a caller who wants some general advice. What type of tomatoes are good to grow in containers?
Probably the tomatoes we've talked in the past, but I'll mention it again. There's determinate tomatoes and indeterminate tomatoes. Determinate tomatoes only get so high, and then the stem terminates in a blossom cluster, so they only get that tall, versus the indeterminates, which most of the heirlooms are, which just keep, they never get a terminal blossom, so they just perpetually get taller until they freeze. So something that's a little compact in size would be good because you're going to be dealing with a limited soil volume. If you can find a good description of it, things that there's used to be one called Patio that was good. It was a salad sized tomato, which is considerably bigger than a cherry, but not huge. But generally look for compact size just so that you're not overwhelming the capacity of the soil in the container to to take care of
it. Got to have some nutrients in there.
Right.
Okay. And that caller has another question, but before I get to that, let's take a cell phone call here on line one. Good afternoon. Caller on line one. There.
Hello there.
Hi there.
Can you hear me?
Yeah,
okay.
Go ahead.
I live in a suburb of Champaign, and of course they use a lot of heavy clay backfill, and we're trying to establish a good perennial garden. And I was wondering if top dressing the soil with compost would allow some of that heavy clay to break up and help with nutrients and water. I'll let you comment on that, and I'll turn the radio back on.
Okay.
Okay. Yes, that will eventually help the situation. If you're where you're just starting out, you might want to be more aggressive than that and stockpile a whole bunch of organic things, leaves, grass clippings, whatever, mix them up and actually mix that into the volume of soil that you're going to be growing things in so that putting sprinkling compost on the surface and tilling that in is not a bad thing, but the more that you can get in there before you get plants in there, the better that's going to be. So the other thing is if it's a really bad clay situation, and I know a lot of these backfill situations are that way, you might want to go to a raised bed and just create a soil that maybe uses some of that clay material, but is mainly composed of compost and rotted manures and good stuff that you bring in. Sometimes that's the best, and then over the course of many years, earthworms and different things may incorporate more of that clay into it, and you may get to a good point with some of the native material. But in the meantime, you've got whatever the depth of your raised bed is, that's really ideal, and sometimes it's easier to work on that limited volume and do it that way.
And you can do that raised bed maybe with some stonework or so. It's
sure
would be
yeah
really
yeah
lovely.
It doesn't have to be with landscape timbers. It can be with whatever material comes to hand. It could be concrete blocks if you had a supply of used concrete blocks. It can be the stuff that looks like wood that's really melted down old milk cartons. Any number of things that just hold the soil, mm-hmm. and then maybe if you can get at least a 50-50, the best clay that you have on the site to the best organic matter that you can find, that would be good. If the soil is really terrible, the compost will eventually make it better, but not really fast enough to establish really nice perennial flower plantings or even a nice vegetable garden.
How if you were not gonna do a raised bed, how deep would you need to go?
Well, again, best case scenario, you would double dig that, so you would go down 12 to maybe 18 inches and incorporate organic matter and good stuff, in layers through all of that. You don't want the 18 inches down up on the surface because chances are fairly good that 18 inches down is going to be even worse than what's on the surface. Although sometimes you never know with backfill, you may go down a foot and then actually hit native soil.
Good stuff. Yeah.
So you never know what you're going to find. But double digging it to get it aerated is, air is the second best thing to organic matter to improve the soil. Just get some air in there so the roots can breathe.
Okay. And that previous caller where we talked about tomatoes had a question about blueberries. Can you do blueberries in containers?
Probably you can. Through most of Illinois, you'd want to have somewhere protected to put them in the winter. Like you might want to bury the pots and maybe put leaves or something or some wrap up the tops. Because just blueberries in a container sitting outside the freezing and thawing, and they might not be real hardy doing it that way. As far as growing them in containers, yes. If you do use something that's high in peat that has a low pH, they may grow better in that acid condition in a container than they would
in our soils
which are typically fairly alkaline.
Okay, very good. Well, That's where we'll leave it. Chuck Voigt has been our guest this afternoon. We've used up the time, and it was a pleasure to have you here this afternoon. Have a great remainder of the summer. Chuck Voigt is Principal Research Specialist in Agriculture, Natural Resources, and Environmental Sciences at the University of Illinois. He's also co-author of the book Vegetable Gardening in the Midwest. 9 minutes before 2 o'clock, settlement prices should be in from the Chicago Board of Trade. Here's Dave Tickey.
Thank you very much, Celeste, and good afternoon, everyone. Well, what a difference a day makes at the Chicago Board of Trade. A lot of green on the screen today at the end of the week, even though on weekly charts, we're going to, as we talk about later today on our closing market report, we're down across the grain complexes. Could have been worse, though, and we'll get to those numbers just right quick. September wheat, a high on the day of 330 and a half, a low of 325 and a half, settling 328 and three quarters, up six. December, a high of 343 and a quarter, a low of 338 and three quarters, settling 342 and a quarter, up six. March, a high of 354 and a half, a low of 350 and a half, settling 353 and three quarters, up six. May, a high of 359, a low of 356, settling 357 and a half, up seven and a half. July wheat, a high of 360, a low of 356, settling 360, up seven and a quarter on the day. September corn, a high of 225 and a quarter, a low of 222 and a half, settling 223 and three quarters, up four and a half. December, a high of 233 and a half, a low of 230 and a half, settling 232, up four and a quarter. March, a high of 242, a low of 239, settling 240 and a half, up four and a half. May, a high of 248 and a quarter, a low of 244 and three quarters, settling 246 and three quarters, up four and three quarters. July, a high of 252 and a quarter, a low of 249 and a quarter, settling 251 and a half, up five. September, a high of 254 and a quarter, a low of 252 and three quarters, settling 253 and a half, up three and a half. September oats, a high of 130, a low of 125 and a quarter, settling 125 and three quarters, up one and a half. December, a high of 136, a low of 132, settling 133 and a half, up one and three quarters. August soybeans, a high of 680 and a half, a low of 661, settling 669 and a half, up 12. September, a high of 623, a low of 609, settling 621 and a quarter, up 20 and three quarters. November, a high of 615, a low of 599, settling 611 and a half, up 17 and three quarters. January, a high of 620, a low of 607, settling 619, up 19 and a half. March, a high of 626, a low of 612, settling 625, up 17 and a half. May, a high of 632, a low of 615, settling 628, up 18 and a half on the day. August soybean meal, the low number in the red today, a high of 222.50, a low of 217, settling 218, down a dollar. September, a high of 204.50, a low of 198.50, settling 201.70, up 540. August soybean oil, a high of 24.92, a low of 24.50, settling 24.72, up 32. September, a high of 24.15, a low of 23.76, settling 23.96, up 21 on the day. Settlement prices are also in on the Chicago Mercantile Exchange, and Celeste, very much a mixed day today.
Indeed. Let's take a look at these prices here this afternoon. August feeder cattle, the high 114.80, the low 113.25, the settlement 114.70, that up a nickel. September feeder cattle, 113.75, the high 112.50, the low 113.72 and a half, the settlement, that up 5. October feeder cattle, 111.85, the high 110.70, the low 111.72 and a half, the settlement, that down 2 and a half. August live cattle, today's high 87.45, the low 86.20, the settlement 86.90, that down 107 and a half. October 90 even, the high 88.75, the low 89.30, the final price, that down 82 and a half. August lean hog, 75.70 the high, 74.65 the low, 75.57.5 the settlement, that up 145. October, 65.80 the high, 64.85 the low, 65.47.5 the settlement, that up 77.5. December, 61.40 the high, 60.65 the low, 61.02.5 the settlement, that up 22.5. February lean hog, 61.75 the high, 61 even the low. The settlement, 61.25, that down 12.5. July bellies, today's high, 113.70, the low, 110.60. The settlement, 113.70, that up the limit, up $3. The Dow Jones Industrial Average now down 89 points at 99.62. The NASDAQ off 37 at 18.52. And the S&P 500 11 lower at 10.86.
The Carl Center for Rural Health and Farm Safety is proud to underwrite agricultural programming on WILL. The center helps residents of rural communities with education and training in farm safety. For more information, call 217-383-4606. Today's programming is made possible in part by a grant from Birkenstock Concepts by Heel to Toe in downtown Urbana. For over 25 years, offering all sizes and widths of Birkenstocks, from clogs and sandals to work, dress, and sports shoes. Birkenstock Concepts offers repair and modification services and a certified podorthist and orthotist on staff.
It's time once again to Ask Dr. Science. So let's ask Dr. Science.
That's me.
Remember, he knows more than you do.
That's right.
Tammy Baker from Columbus, South Carolina writes, "Dear Dr. Science, my son is threatening to clone himself. What should I say to him?"
Tell him he'd be violating federal law and would spend the rest of his life in prison, leaving you alone and helpless with a young clone to raise. You leave out some pertinent data. Why does he want a clone? To do his homework for him while he's off listening to Chumbawamba with his worthless friends? Well, if that's the case, throw him in jail and hope you have better luck with the clone. Seriously, cloning should only be done as a hobby. It's what I do alone on a winter's night if I can't find a jigsaw puzzle. But using clones to get out of work, well, that's a violation of ethics. That's why God gave us lab assistants.
Thank you, Dr. Science. Send your science questions to Ask Dr. Science. Remember, he's not a real doctor.
I have a master's degree
in science.
Produced by Next Breath and distributed by PRI, Public Radio International. To order the Dr. Science Get Smart Kit with new CD, screensaver for PCs, and a master's degree mouse pad, call 800-989-DUCK.
Today's programming is made possible in part by grants from 10,000 villages in downtown Champaign and Crossroads Global Handcrafts, 428 North Main in Bloomington, offering ground and whole bean coffee purchased from farmers using internationally recognized fair trade standards.
You're tuned to AM 580 WILL, Urbana, the broadcasting service of the University of Illinois. 1 minute before.